From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson alongside Megan Mack. And we're going to start this edition of the podcast with a question. When we talk about DACA, building a wall, and immigration policy, what are we really talking about? In a recent piece for Vox.com, writer Will Wilkinson said the immigration debate is actually about whether Latinos are considered real Americans. He says nativism, as far as the White House, is helping set immigration policy.
Our guests discuss those issues and how Hispanic Americans are affected by the debate. Tricia Cruz Irving is the Director of Development and Communications for the Ibero-American Action League. And in this clip, you'll hear her share a story about a call she received at her office from a man who said he was against immigration.
This is something that happened, I think it was back last August, 2017, and I've never forgotten it. I was in my office at Ibero, and the phone rings. And the man on the other end, the first thing he says to me, "Can you tell me why it is that Puerto Ricans have to fly their flag on their car the way that they do?" And I think this was like around the Puerto Rican festival.
Okay.
And, you know, I ended up engaging him for 40 minutes, where I know that probably anybody else in my situation would have hung up on him. But, you know, we proceeded to talk, and he was very clear about his views that, you know, he didn't support immigration. He didn't understand a lot of the things that people from different cultures did. And, you know, but he didn't insult me. He wasn't, you know, rude or anything. He was just stating his views. And I decided to stay on the phone with him for a couple of reasons. Because one, I knew that anybody else would have hung up on him. And I was like, you know what, at least let me see if we can have a civil conversation. Because at least, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, you know, lately, nowadays, in the last couple of years, for many years now, is when you have a different point of view, sometimes people get very defensive and you can't talk to them. You know, it's nice if we could just get in the room, and if you have a different point of view, that's okay, you know, because we all have different experiences, both personal and professional, that have shaped us into who we are. So I sat on the phone with him for 40 minutes, and he, you know, was expressing his views, and he came out and said, you know, I'm a 60-year-old white man who's retired, probably with too much time on my hands. So we were talking, and I was trying to give him a different point of view from my perspective. And I will tell you that by the end of that conversation, he said to me, and I had asked him at one point, I was like, "Would you say that you're racist?" And he's like, "You know, that's a really good question." And he said, "Probably." But at the end of that conversation, he says to me, "You know what, Ms. Cruz?" He's like, "You've given me a lot to think about. Would it be okay if I called you from time to time just to pick your brain about things that I just don't understand?" And to me, that was amazing, because here you have somebody who was very clear and set in his ways, did not support immigration, didn't like the idea of other people being here from different countries, different ethnic backgrounds. But I engaged him in a conversation, and at the very end, he could have just been like, "No, I don't agree with you. I don't like you. You shouldn't be here either." But no, at the end, what he did was, "Thank you for giving me some things to think about. Is it okay if I call you back every so often?" And he did. And every once in a while, he's called me just to ask me my opinion on something. And then one time, he even called me because something happened in the news where somebody, a Hispanic American, was being recognized for doing something good with the U.S. military. I don't remember the specifics. And he called to share that story with me because he thought that was something nice.
Next, Jordan Peele's horror film Get Out won Best Screenplay at this year's Oscars, and it's generating a lot of buzz. We won't reveal too much about the plot, in case you haven't seen it, but we can say that it's a remarkably well-done film that provides social commentary on race relations.
In one scene of the film, the main character, an African-American man named Chris, attends a party thrown by his white girlfriend's family. One of the guests, an old golf pro, talks about his game and tells Chris he knows Tiger Woods. It's that type of awkward comment that can come across as patronizing or even racist. And it's the type of conversation that black people say they hear at parties with white people all the time.
Chris Thompson is a local engineer, comedian, and activist. He described how those types of comments make him feel as a black man. You'll hear from him in this clip, but first, here's Daniel Kaluuya, who played the character Chris in Get Out. He's describing his thoughts on that party scene.
When everyone was kind of trying to make Chris feel welcome and comfortable by keeping on asking him questions about blackness, and I was like, "I've been to that party. I go to that party. I'm going to that party soon. I don't know when." It's like I know that. I know that. And that's, I don't know if any other, that's the same. You know, I don't think that's the same. I don't think it manifests in the same way when people go, I'm really cool with this. Yo, have you seen this basketball game? I go, bro, I'm English. I don't care about basketball, man. I play, watch football, bro. And I, so it, and that's, and so it's that kind of thing.
Remarkable. So that's why this one small example of why this movie is not just a horror film, we do a disservice by just calling it a horror film. Chris, your thoughts on what Daniel's describing, what Jordan Peele wanted to do with that?
Well, living in Rochester for 9 years after living in Baltimore for nearly 14, I completely got what he was talking about. Like, I have been to those parties. And, like, everything he's talking about is stuff that a lot of black people have experienced. And usually we have no choice but to experience, because if we're going to be out in the world in general, it's going to happen. You know, like every corporate event that I go to, every house party that I'm invited to, I worry about those uncomfortable conversations. It's gotten a lot better. I notice this is one thing. I feel like it's gotten a lot better since the movie came out. Like the last couple of months, people don't try to throw those things in.
What do people say to you?
Just like over patronizing behavior. Like when I was younger, you know, there'd be like talks of why I'm not playing basketball or I should join the company basketball team. It's like, have you seen me even try to pick up a pen? Like, this is not going to happen. Just talking about things like one thing that I love is there's always one white dude at the party who thinks he's down, who will recite to you like obscure hip hop lyrics. And I'm like, okay, great. I don't know who that is. Like, how do you not know that? You're not really down with hip hop. I was like, well, not that song or not that artist. Like, there's always one. There's always one every party I go to.
A white guy doing hip hop. Are they trying to show credentials of being sort of?
I think they're trying to get their hood passed, but like that's not something that exists. So you don't get one. Like, it's just like, okay, yeah, great. You know Jam Master Jay's birthday. That's fine. Doesn't mean anything to me. And I mean, Run DMC means something to me, but like you knowing that, good for you.
And it comes up in a way that's totally inorganic, right?
Right. Like I'll be talking about how good the pasta salad is and then, you know.
By the way.
Right.
They'll drop the Ricky Gervais as the boss in the original BBC version of The Office. Ricky Gervais' character goes up to the only black guy in the office and says, you know who my favorite actor is of all time? Sidney Poitier.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just like that.
I'm like, great.
Why?
Why are we talking about this?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Daniel is saying it happens. And this is something that, you know, again, I never have to experience. And my goodness, I hope I'm not the guy doing that. I mean, but I think part of what Jordan Peele wanted us to do is see how sometimes it's well-intended and subconscious. But I want to ask you, does it hurt? Is it awkward? Is it demeaning?
Okay, so it's only awkward if you make it awkward, but it does generate like at least an internal eye roll. And what that does to me is like when that person does that, I'm just like kind of turned off of them. Like it doesn't matter what they say after that. I'm just like, I don't really want to talk to you. And then I'll just go off and talk to other people.
I mean, how many white people are going to go up to their black friends at the next party and be like, you know what film I love this year? Black Panther.
I think, well...
But the problem is I loved Black Panther.
Yeah, everybody loves Black Panther. That's the problem. Like,
I know.
Now I don't know. But like,
I know, Get Out was so good. I was sort of hoping not to like it for that reason. Because now I look patronized. It was truly a remarkable film.
Next, a number of elite athletes have come forward in recent months to share their struggles with eating disorders. Olympic figure skater Adam Rippon is one of them. He says the pressure to lose weight and land more jumps led him to a daily diet of 3 slices of whole grain bread, topped with a pat of I can't believe it's not butter. Well, now he's speaking out about his disorder to help other athletes with disordered eating seek help.
In this clip, you'll hear a local soccer star describe her struggle with an eating disorder. Amy O'Sullivan was the captain of the soccer team at the University of Maryland, and now she's an advocate for eating disorder awareness. O'Sullivan says her drive to be a top athlete fueled her eating disorder.
When I was young, I restricted. I wanted to be thin. I wanted to look the part of an athlete. I was going through, you know, normal changes a young female would, and that was uncomfortable given what I thought was the ideal image. Transitioning into Maryland, when I began to take exercise to a different level, it was no longer restriction. It was extreme exercise with extreme orthorexic tendencies, which means eating really, really healthy foods all the time, with an increased fear of bad foods that they would hurt my performance.
And for listeners who hear that and think, well, you're eating healthy foods all the time, but it sounds like almost an obsession.
Absolutely an obsession. So the thing about an eating disorder is it controls you, as opposed to me controlling the activity or the food. And so in both of these cases, I was a victim to what my exercise regimen was, what my food schedule was, and it was a constant thought. So it definitely controlled me more than I being in the upper hand.
Did you know it at the time?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think to some extent I noticed that I had convinced myself that it was helping me. But I think what happens to athletes often is, right, you're in this world where you win at all costs, where extremes are reinforced, where no pain, no gain is the mantra. So it's almost as if you fall subconsciously to the eating disorder because you think you're doing the best thing for your career. And so all of a sudden you wake up and you're a victim to this disease. I think it heightens mostly when the career ends, right? Because you're left without that identity and all you know is how to control those aspects, the food and the body. But I do think when you're in it, you think you're doing the best thing you can possibly do to succeed. And what are you being told? Do the best thing you possibly can do to succeed. From coaches, from parents, from even just game results. You went to the extreme, you won the game against UNC. You know, and so how else can you not take external reward and think it's something to do with the way that you're living?
Were you ever eating a candy bar, a cookie, a piece of cake at a party in those days?
I would say rarely. Honestly, rarely. Even, you know, when I was named captain at Maryland, it was because of the standards that I had set in fitness levels and what I had done in the weight room and what I had done with my regimen, my food regimen. I remember coach asking me to take girls grocery shopping. So there was only
wow.
Positive reinforcement mm-hmm. behind the way that I was living. So I would, I think, if I really had to, but it, you know what it did, and this is what we see with people that are recovered or not, is how much does it take you out of the present moment? So where did I go when I did engage in something that was outside of my typical schedule or comfort level, my mind had so many stories and so many thoughts that I was really not present with anything I was doing.
So take me then beyond college and how things have evolved for you and how you got to this point where you're sitting here as an advocate for awareness and for healthy mindsets and healthy eating.
After graduating from Maryland, I had intentions of going to law school and it wasn't what I wanted to do at all, and I wanted to continue being competitive. I actually transitioned into the fashion industry. So I modeled in New York City and overseas for 4 years, which again was an industry that not only normalized such behavior, but glamorized it and was extremely lucrative. So I continually was fueled with external reward that told me everything I was doing was right. And so I operated that way for another 4 years. And honestly, whether I knew it or not, I still thought I was being the best me. And it wasn't until I lost my mind. My brain didn't have enough. I continued to train as an athlete, so my biggest thing was extreme exercise. I trained like an athlete. I was no longer playing Duke or UNC, so I wasn't exactly eating as if I was an athlete. And still super healthy, but your brain needs carbohydrates all the time. It needs fats. It needs substance. And I fell pretty quickly.
Were you not eating much?
I was not eating nearly enough for how much I was working out. And that physique was, again, booking me big jobs and continuing to have positive rewards. So I left very little time to question it. And so what happened was I fell flat on my face, and my parents came, and my biggest support systems through my family. I did some inpatient time. I did a little cycle of treatment time. I met a wonderful woman named Allie, and I remember thinking in the stages, this is not my life. And there were characteristics as an athlete that were detrimental and encouraged the eating disorder. There are also characteristics that I grew to be who I was that could get me through this. So I tapped into those. I actually used a lot of positive psychology. So UPenn has a master's in it, which I hope to be going to shortly, and I'm certified in. And that, helped me rewire my brain and helped me to think differently. And I recovered, I would say, better than I've ever been. And now I'm in a place of knowing that these professions that I was in don't have to be the way they are. Right, you can be successful as an athlete, you can be successful as a model actress without the eating disorder. The problem is the eating disorder is often an illusion that allows people to think that is what's driving their success.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will talk to you Monday.